Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. As we mentioned last week, if you were listening, health is more dependent on socioeconomic factors than actually on health care. For example, social factors such as stress, neglect, and abuse early in life can affect the developing brain, and this leads to social, emotional, and even cognitive impairments that can be lifelong. These changes can then lead to the adoption of high-risk behaviors, illnesses, social problems, and even a shorter life expectancy. Today, we're going to focus on one social problem and risky behavior, and that's the use of alcohol and the unfortunate outcome that can result in lifelong effects of alcohol on the brain of a developing child, which might be exposed to alcohol before birth. To discuss the prevention of these effects of fetal alcohol exposure, our guests today are Marilyn Pierce Bulger. She's an advanced nurse practitioner and owner of FAS Diagnostic Services, the referral and coordination agency for the Anchorage Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders Diagnostic Team. And luckily, joining us by phone is Kathleen Tavner Mitchell. I say luckily since I forgot to bring her phone number, and we scavenged it at the last minute. Kathleen's an interesting person. She's vice president and international spokesperson for the National Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. She's also has a master's of human services degree and is a licensed clinical alcohol and drug counselor with 33 years experience. She was appointed by the former Secretary of Health and Human Services to serve on the U.S. National Task Force on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, and actually even served on a World Health Organization committee for developing guidelines on the identification and management of substance abuse disorders in pregnancy. She has a very interesting personal story, which we'll discuss today, and it was featured in, and has been featured, I should say, in many documentaries, newspapers, news stories, articles, and other publications. And in January 2016, when the Washington Post covered her story, it went viral, and by day three, it had been viewed by over almost 9 million different viewers. So welcome, Kathleen. I'm glad we finally made the contact. And Marilyn, thanks for returning.
Happy to be here.
For those of you
I'm happy to be here.
All right, thank you. For those who are listening, thanks for listening. And if you have questions during the discussion today, or you have comments, in Anchorage, our local number, for those of you who may not have that, is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1 at alaskapublic.org. Wow. So, Kathy, let's start off by telling us a little bit about the National Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome.
Great. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I'm really so pleased to be a part of this program. Yeah, the National Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, known as NOFAS, we're working on our 27th year. And I have been involved at NOFAS for 27 years, starting out as a volunteer, but NOFAS has really been instrumental in many of the kind of first in addressing FASD, certainly in Congress and in developing materials to educate both healthcare providers, K through 12 students, high risk populations, and just the general community.
And the headquarters is in Washington?
We are. We're in Washington, D.C., and get to be a part of all the fun events in Washington. But we're in Washington, D.C., and, you know, a big part of what we do is to continue to educate Congress and, you know, to ensure that, you know, there are appropriations available so that the agencies can address FASD. And the main agencies, federal agencies that are charged with addressing FASD would include the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, and NIH, NIAAA, the Alcoholism and Alcohol Abuse Institute, and Those are the two main ones right now. There's a few agencies that have some small projects, but mainly it's CDC and NIAAA.
All right. Thanks very much. And Marilyn, how about tell us about your organization and how you're involved?
So FAS Diagnostic Services is the coordination hub for the Anchorage FASD Diagnostic Team, which is funded by State of Alaska Division of Behavioral Health. We accept referrals from a variety of sources here in Anchorage and some from other parts of the state for children and individuals who are seeking diagnosis. The team here in Anchorage is entirely a volunteer health professional team, and they all work in their own respective practices, so we're running a community-based model. And we use the University of Washington four-digit code diagnostic process. All of the teams here in Alaska use that, and all of the team members for teams in Alaska are trained in the University of Washington model.
So where are other diagnostic teams located?
The current active teams are in Kenai-Soldotna area and Fairbanks, both of which have been functioning since the early 2000s when we had money from the federal government. And Juneau is functioning again. They were also one of the early teams and then had some difficulties for a time period. Sitka, Nome, and I'm forgetting one, I think. But I think the numbers have decreased significantly. Early on, we had about 14 teams, and it's been very difficult to maintain and sustain those diagnostic teams around the state, in part because of health professional transience and community readiness for diagnosis.
So in communities throughout Alaska that don't have a diagnostic team, then people or individuals are referred into the one of these four for diagnosis?
Correct, yeah.
All right, so let's try to put some kind of face, some kind of understanding about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders for our listeners. I think many people have probably heard the term fetal alcohol syndrome, so I just use the term fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Could one of you help us understand what we mean by the spectrum of disorders instead of just fetal alcohol syndrome? Or in addition to, I should say.
I have to say, in Alaska, individuals are very familiar with the term FASD, but that in and of itself is not a diagnosis. As you say that, it's a spectrum of diagnoses. Full fetal alcohol syndrome is actually relatively uncommon in what we refer to as the tip of the iceberg, in that only about 9 to 10% of individuals coming through a diagnostic team meet the criteria, which include a pattern of three facial features that we look at, growth deficiency or short stature below the 10th percentile generally, and evidence of brain-based differences. There are other individuals who have evidence of brain-based differences to different extents, some of whom have the same level of impairment as an individual with full FAS, but they don't have the facial features or the growth issue. Those individuals, using the UW terminology, have a static encephalopathy, which is referring to evidence of brain-based pathology that's not progressive, like an Alzheimer's would be a progressive condition. Other individuals might have somewhat less evidence of a brain-based difference, and they may meet criteria for neurobehavioral disorder. And nationally, Kathy, you might want to talk a little bit about this, because the Institute of Medicine uses slightly different terminology, and there's kind of an East Coast, West Coast difference in some other terms.
Well, I think we had a summit on the FASD terminology, I think it was in 2004, and got all of the agencies to at least agree that we could all agree to using FASD as an umbrella term that would encompass the range of adverse outcomes related to fetal alcohol exposure. And I think it's important, one of the things Marilyn talked about, it's important to understand that there is a spectrum. And in order to have a diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome, which is a term many more people are familiar with, it's that the drinking has to occur during a very narrow time window, approximately the 17th day of pregnancy. And so most women wouldn't even know that they were pregnant at that point in time. So that, you know, kind of tells the story of why the majority of people that may have a fact don't have the full expression. They don't have the facial features, that the very specific features that are associated with drinking during pregnancy. And there is a whole host of research and literature that is really pointing towards many other factors that probably impact the developing fetus along with the alcohol.
That's right.
So that in medical terms, there are multiple cofactors that might interact to lead to the full expression of this toxin's effect is what I hear you saying.
Right. Some of these things may be potentiating it. Exactly.
Uh-huh. All right. So we're going to have another program in September where we really get into the diagnosis a lot. I think it's still nevertheless important that we have a general understanding of the listeners of what's going on, and we're going to focus eventually here on prevention. But I would like to ferret out a little bit more about this disorder. So let's talk about some of what's called the epidemiology. Who is infected? Is there a socioeconomic group? Are there selected individuals that are higher risk? What do we know about that?
Well, unfortunately, FASD is an equal opportunity disability. So we're seeing this disability across socioeconomic and ethnic groups. One of the alarming trends that we're seeing nationally now is that we're seeing a very big increases in terms of binge pattern drinking, and we'll talk more about that in a minute, on the part of women. And many of these women are in their 30s, they're college educated, they're white, they're working, they're individuals who might otherwise during pregnancy be very careful about exposures, but may think nothing of continuing to have a glass of wine or a beer while they're pregnant. And unfortunately, all types of alcohol can cause some difficulties.
Let me take a quick second to remind listeners again, if you've got questions or comments about the program, our local number 550-8433. Our email address is line1, and you'll need to spell that out, LINEONE, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. So let's talk a little bit about the amount, the kinds, the timing of alcohol and what we know about its effects. Who would like to chime in on that?
Kathy, you want me to?
Let me just add, if I could, just add a notation on the prevalence, because I think it's important for listeners to understand that in the U.S. overall, FASD has been estimated to be 2 to 5%, and that is a rate equal to or greater than that for autism spectrum disorder. So it really is, it's a very common disorder, although it, you know, it's just not identified, or, you know, people just don't get the diagnosis. And again, some of the other variables can include that can, you know, influence the severity. It can include things like malnourishment and trauma and the use of other drugs. And that's where you can get into, you know, you're talking about the amounts of alcohol and the timing, but also some of these other variables. So again, it can happen to anybody from any walk of life, any color, any ethnicity, any religious background, but all of these things can kind of play into why one pregnancy would have higher risk factors than others.
Thanks, Kathy. And the other thing that I would like to just mention as well is that we know that children who are in the child protection system are at higher risk, in part because of the reason they're in the child protection system. So the work done at the University of Washington is estimating that there's probably 10 times that rate that she quoted for children who are in the protection system.
It would make sense, and I may be wrong, that younger women are perhaps at a greater risk of having children with fetal alcohol effects, or am I being biased in my thinking here?
I think no. I think if you look at what are the maternal characteristics, these women tend to be older, having had more children. This is for full FAS now. Have had other life stressors that have influenced their current health, as you had with your, discussed on your show last week.
All right.
And, if I may comment on that, because a lot of the research on that question has come out of the University of Washington, where they have a diagnostic clinic, and maybe from Alaska, I don't know. But in our work with birth mothers and surveying our birth mothers through the Circle of Hope, and I can talk more about that a little later, but in surveying women, we find the average age to be 23 years of age when they gave birth to a child with effects.
Great. Thanks, Kathy.
Yeah, and so, now we don't, probably a lot of our birth mothers, they may not, be a part of these large studies done by, University of Washington and others. But and the other piece is that I think is very important is that a lot of the mothers that have children with an FASD also have used other substances and had poor nutrition. So I think those are, if you want to get the real facts about, children that end up getting a diagnosis, this is very common. So we're dealing with the opioid crisis now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our babies were also exposed to opioids. Now, we know that alcohol is a teratogen causing the permanent birth defect. But from a prevention perspective and understanding who is at the highest risk, we have to understand, I think, and be sensitive to all of these risk factors.
I introduced the program by talking about the importance of early experiences in childhood, particularly what are called ACEs, or adverse childhood experiences, and how that can lead in almost a domino effect to later problems in life. But I'm not aware. And I guess I'm kind of asking, are either of you aware that there may be an association between early childhood experiences or stress and anxiety that leads to the use of alcohol during pregnancy and the consequences? Kathy, you'd kind of started, I think, to imply that, and it ties things together. I keep trying to make sure listeners are aware of the importance of the social economic factors in health.
I absolutely believe that to be true. With working, being in this field for many years, I'm a licensed addiction therapist, and working with so many hundreds of birth mothers from all over the world. The majority of women that do give birth to children have experienced adverse childhood experiences and do come from addicted households. That doesn't mean that, that a woman who doesn't grow up with trauma, that if she drinks during pregnancy, especially at higher levels, and is drinking more often, the more you drink, the more often you drink, the higher the risk factors. But with that said, that you can't give birth to a child with FAS and not have, or an FASD, and not have this addiction in your background. But the truth of the matter is that the majority of our women who are in, again, the Circle of Hope, a support network for birth mothers, for women who have used substances during pregnancy and had children, with effects, they have come from very unstable backgrounds. They have experienced addiction and have, and many, I'm happy to report, are maintaining long-term recovery. Not all, but, the goal is to help support women. But I think it's a piece sad that you're getting at that hasn't been researched fully, and we need to understand that aspect more clearly, because I do believe, just from knowing families and women, that is a big piece of the puzzle.
Okay. In some of our interactions and in communications, I know one of you has used the term that alcohol should be thought of somewhat as an environmental pollutant, much like maybe lead or mercury. And I think that's probably makes sense, but I don't think the public thinks of it that way.
They don't. And I'm a nurse midwife as well as a nurse practitioner. And one of the things that I find interesting is that women are often very informed about, don't change the cat box because you're at risk for, you know, toxoplasmosis if you have an indoor-outdoor cat. Avoid certain kinds of fish that may contain mercury. If you're in a old building, be aware whether or not you have lead-based paint in your environment. Those kinds of things seem to be more well-known, both by health providers and by women. And we just don't think of alcohol in the same way. And I think part of that, and I'd love to hear Kathy's thoughts about this too, is that alcohol is such a common part of our culture that it's fairly ubiquitous. We use it for a lot of things. We use it for celebration, for memorials, at sports events. It's a rite of passage for, you know, somebody to turn 21. It's it can be a self-medication option. I've had women tell me in my practice over the years who had very significant mental health conditions that our behavioral health system was so challenging for them to actually enter or use that it was easier for them to go and get alcohol, for example, than it is to go and do an intake in a behavioral health system and jump through the hoops needed in order to access medications, et cetera. Kathy, I'd love to have you add on to that.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and it's just, you know, we love alcohol. I mean, globally, it's a global problem. It's not
right.
just a U.S.
Right.
problem. I mean,
right. that's right.
People, there's a reluctance to suggest that someone actually give up alcohol. And, I mean, look at our college campuses, for goodness sakes. I mean, a lot of the kids that go off to college and universities aren't even legally of age to drink, but it's widely accepted that, you know, these kids drink excessively often. And, you know, it's just so interesting to me, like you were pointing out, Marilyn, that people will, they'll stop dyeing their hair and they don't eat tuna fish, you know.
Right.
And it's funny, one of our interns one year did their own little project and they looked at the neurotoxins in a can of tuna fish. And if you were to get the same neurotoxins that you would in a 5-ounce glass of wine, you would have to eat 42 cans of tuna fish in one setting. So just to give you an idea of, you know, people are afraid of other neurotoxins, other environmental pollutants, but the alcohol, boy, they just don't want to hear about it.
Yeah. That's generally true. The human mind works in strange ways. We worry more about very unusual risks and don't worry about driving a car, drinking alcohol, which are some of two of the biggest risks we have. It's just interesting.
Right.
Familiarity breeds a little bit of safety feelings, I guess.
Yeah.
We haven't fleshed out the long-term effects well here. Kathy, you want to tell us kind of your story here to help us understand that?
Sure. You know, I have a daughter, a birth daughter, with the full-blown fetal alcohol syndrome, and I'm actually even hesitant to say that anymore because it really, she's under the spectrum of FASD, but she has, she's on the severe end of the spectrum. And basically, my story, the short version is I grew up in a very loving home, 7 children, 2 parents that hard workers. My father owned restaurants. And this was back in the, you know, late 60s and 70s when there was family style restaurants, and so these large families would come in with big bowls of fried chicken and everything. And all seven of us worked in that restaurant. So we started working in my dad's restaurant when we were probably about 7, 8 years old, being pouring waters and clearing the tables. And what happened was that my father suffered with alcoholism, but we didn't have language for that. We didn't know what it was. We didn't know why his behavior changed. And I was number 5 out of 7. And I think this is an important piece to the puzzle, is not when I started drinking, but my childhood, because this is where, you know, these are the issues that we have to look at when we're trying to help women to get sober and to remain in recovery and achieve long-term recovery. But my father's father apparently was an alcoholic. He was a congressman, and my mother's father was an alcoholic. So kind of looking back through the family tree on both sides, there's a lot of addiction, a lot of alcoholism. But back in those days, it was covered up. It was very shameful and very stigmatized, as it is today, actually. But people weren't so open about it. And what happened for me was I was kind of caught up in this very chaotic world, and my dad's progression, just things got worse and worse at home. There was a lot of, the language I have for today, we would call it domestic violence. What we called it when I was growing up was, dad isn't talking right, and he's coming in late, and mom's mad, and there's going to be a big fight. And so I grew up having two younger sisters that I would kind of crawl in my bed at nighttime when we would start to hear it happening, and that is the domestic violence stuff. And again, I don't share any of this to disrespect my parents. Again, they were really wonderful people, and we got to witness, actually, my father get sober and live a sober lifestyle the last 20 years of his life thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that's an important piece of the puzzle, too, is to understand that children that grow up in families like this understand that their parents have a disease, and it wasn't about them being bad or them being unlovable. It was really about their parents just not getting the help that they need. So what happened for me was I grew up there was a lot of post-traumatic stress. There was a lot of anxiety. I was kind of, I call it the birthing process of my codependency, my caretaking, because I would go off to school in second or third grade after a large fight had occurred in our household, and I would tuck my younger sisters into a closet and tell them to be quiet as a mouse till Kathy got back from school. So, of course, the whole time in school, I'm just a nervous wreck and sweating and can't wait to get home. And, of course, I'm playing this vision of my mother might be dead before I get home, those kinds of things. So these are the things that children of alcoholics live with. And this is the piece, Bad, that you talked about that I think is overlooked in the field of FASD, this role of these adverse effects on children. But I started using alcohol and other drugs very early on. My first drug was nicotine. I kind of taught myself how to smoke when I was 12 years of age. And I started to, kind of drink leftover drinks. Like I said, my parents had a restaurant. They entertained in their house, would have parties, and we'd wake up in the morning and there'd be leftover whiskey sours, and we would kind of run around and drink those. And then, it was now, the late 60s, and I'm in junior high. And so I am now drinking. I'm a kid that's drinking on the weekends. And when I drink, I can drink a lot more than all the other kids. And that's called a tolerance, which is one of the early indicators of addiction, of alcoholism. And when I would drink I would have a blackout, periods of time that I could not remember what I did. So I'd go to school on Monday and have no recollection. The other kids would tell me some of the crazy things I would do. And then I developed these defense mechanisms. So I became kind of hostile and angry and would snap back at them, and because I couldn't remember the things they were telling me I had done. So these, if I got a hold of me when I was 14 in my adult life now, I would have diagnosed me with alcoholism. Hmm. I had the family history, the blackouts, and the high tolerance. And under the influence of alcohol and an alcoholic blackout, I was introduced to marijuana, introduced to LSD, to amphetamines, which we called speed back then, angel dust, which is PCP, and eventually heroin. And heroin was a big drug back in those days. We were getting heroin from our older siblings, older brothers that were in Vietnam. So long story short, I was a mess and using all kinds of drugs very early on. Got pregnant in high school. In 10th grade, I dropped out. And as soon as I got pregnant, I stopped using all the drugs because I knew they weren't good for the baby. And I continued to drink. I didn't drink every day. I drank more on the weekends. I was a teenager. I smoked cigarettes. And I smoked marijuana, believing that was something natural, that, you know, it was a weed and it should be legal. That's how I thought about things back then. And went on to have three children with the father of that baby. We got married, by the way, got married when I was 16 and gave birth to my son a month after I turned 17. And went on to have three children. And in all three of those pregnancies, I drank alcohol. And I ended up leaving him, getting married to another man. By the way, my first and second husband both suffered with addiction. And, of course, water seeks its own level. I didn't realize any of this at the time, none of it. I was just like a leaf blowing in the wind. I had two children with my second husband. My fourth baby, a little boy, died at birth, and my fifth baby, a little girl, I found her lifeless in her crib when she was almost 3 months of age. And with all of those pregnancies, they were exposed. And my last two, I was on methadone to treat my opioid addiction, my heroin addiction, and was on a clinic for people using, you know, a methadone clinic, and I drank. And with all of those pregnancies, I had no idea that you weren't supposed to drink. No one ever mentioned it anywhere. And so I ended up, thank God, getting into recovery soon after my daughter died. I started to sift through the ruins of my past and figure all this out. My daughter at that point, who was 15, was diagnosed with cerebral palsy, and I ended up bringing her to Georgetown University and told them I drank when I was pregnant, and she ended up with a diagnosis of fetal alcohol syndrome. So I had five children. I have one, Carly. Again, she has intellectual disability. She just moved out for the first time in her life to a group home. She's the love of my life. She's a beautiful human being, but she has intellectual disability, and she's developmentally about 6 years of age. My other two children have not had it easy. They went through a terrible time in their childhood. They were both exposed and may have effects from being exposed, but none that have ever been diagnosed. My one daughter lives with lupus, and she's chronically ill, and I happen to think that is probably due to being prenatally exposed. And my last two children died, and I am actually going to stop talking now, I promise, but I will tell you that I am happily married to a man that doesn't beat me, doesn't say negative things to me or my kids. And he is a wonderful man in recovery. We've been married for 25 years, and I've been in recovery now for 33 years. So my life has changed drastically. We have 5 grandchildren, and not one of my grandchildren has been exposed to one drop of alcohol. So when we help one woman to get sober, we help an entire tribe of people that we have yet to meet.
Wow, that's quite a story. Thanks, Kathy, for sharing that. I'm amazed. I feel better for having heard the story. Hopefully, others have, and I certainly want to continue this discussion, particularly to use this discussion as a jumping-off place for talking about prevention. But we have to take just a very short 1-minute break, and then we're going to come back to talk some more about fetal alcohol syndrome and disorders, and particularly that prevention. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number again, 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a 1-minute break, and we'll continue to discuss the prevention of effects of fetal alcohol exposure with Marilyn Pierce Bulger and Kathleen Tavner Mitchell. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests are Marilyn Pierce Bulger and Kathleen Tavner Mitchell. We're discussing the prevention of lifelong effects of fetal alcohol exposure. Ms. Bulger is an advanced nurse practitioner and owner of the Referral and Coordination Agency for Anchorage Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders Diagnostic Team, and Kathleen Tavner Mitchell is vice president and international spokesperson for the National Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. We just heard her personal story, which has been featured in documentaries and newspapers and news articles and so forth. And it's certainly worth sharing that that story. And you can always refer someone to listen to that by referring them to alaskapublic.org and ask them to find the Line 1 link there, and we can listen to the program at any time from our archives. Please remember also that the program will repeat again tonight on 91.1 Alaska Public Media between 8 and 9 p.m. this evening. And there will be a taped recording at that time, so we won't be able to answer phone calls or answer any emails at that time. So let's get to the prevention. What's the national history? Kathy, I'm going to ask you to give us the national history, and then I'll ask Marilyn to kind of talk about the local Alaska history on prevention efforts.
Well, you know, Congress, the first hearing on FASD occurred in 1990, and I actually had an opportunity to testify at that hearing. And Senator Tom Daschle, then from South Dakota, had introduced that bill. And in 92, the warning labels, the bill that would mandate that all alcohol products have the warning label on them, and again, was testified on behalf of that. And then in 96, the Institute of Medicine had a meeting, and made recommendations for the federal response. So it was in 98 that the Comprehensive Act was enacted. Okay, and that's when the FAS task force had started. And in 99, we got the act, the appropriations to enforce the Comprehensive FASD Act. And as of late 2012, the American Bar Association had a FASD resolution go through. As I said before, the CDC is really the main agency that's involved in prevention. NIAAA does some of that, but they really do a lot of the basic research. So there's been the universal prevention efforts that would be like media campaigns and, you know, the warning labels and things like that. The CDC works on a lot of selective prevention interventions. That would be like screening for women for alcohol use and, educating women about FASD. And what is really lacking, I think, is the indicated prevention interventions. And that's really reaching out to like women at the highest risk for having a child with FAS. And we just never seem to really get to that. We kind of stay more in the overall prevention. But I'll let Marilyn go ahead and talk, because really Alaska is really the premier state and has some really interesting history in terms of what FASD prevention.
Thanks, Kathy. I think that we've been doing work as early as the 1980s. Indian Health Service had a large system of FAS sort of education, screening pregnant women for alcohol use and referral to treatment. In fact, the treatment program here in town called Dina Akoi was first created in the late 80s, I believe. And then there was a fair amount of work done in the early 2000s here when we had federal Substance Abuse Mental Health Administration money over 5 years' time. And the state did a variety of things, including some of the universal messaging Kathy talked about, knowledge, attitude, belief surveys. We tried to get a handle on what the prevalence is here in Alaska, and that continues to be elusive for us. And diagnostic team development was during that time period, and just heightening awareness of the public around alcohol. The interesting thing that I see as a health professional is that my professional colleagues are still quite, I think, uninformed. And this is not specific to the medical field. I would say this is true in educational behavioral health across the board. Many folks may have heard about FAS, full FAS, but they're really not informed about the more subtle and far more frequent hidden disability, which shows up as behavioral and educational and learning and attention problems. So we see a variety of children who are being either missed or misdiagnosed, and that's really a detriment to these kids because then they're not getting effective interventions. And we'll talk more about this with the show the end of end of September, but I think to help health professionals and the public understand that this is a very disabling condition that is preventable if we really focus on how to shift our messaging and, as Kathy says, really look at how we can be more effective with women who are, in fact, struggling with addiction. Having said that, I will say that the screening brief intervention model that we know is a best practice, which should be routinely done in health clinic practices, just adolescent age on up, we really should just be asking about alcohol use and make no assumption about who may or may not be using it and how they might be using it, and opening the door by using a universal screening tool, such as in the U.S. CDC recommends the Audit U.S., which is a simple 3 screening questions asking about alcohol use in the last 30 days or the last year, in terms of what amount and what frequency the individual's drinking. We can help to start have that conversation when somebody isn't pregnant. You know, if we're just having this conversation routinely in our practices, then we're not only bringing it up during a pregnancy. And the goal is really to help inform individuals before they may become pregnant that this is something that really we want to be avoiding and preventing.
So what are the challenges to getting this kind of information across? I mean, we have plenty of information. We have plenty of evidence. We have great personal stories, as we've heard today. And I guess if you were to ask me kind of what Kathy implied earlier, if you asked me where our biggest physical disability kind of thing we're talking about is autism, yet it's one half the incidence at a minimum of fetal alcohol effects.
Right.
So what are all the big, let's just talk about the big barriers to getting this education across to those of us who need it.
I want Kathy to talk about stigma because okay, I think that's number one.
Yeah, and I think, and I also, let me just, before I answer that, let me just underscore some of what Marilyn said because I didn't really respond to the question about the lifelong effects, but I just want to underscore the fact that most individuals, is that this is a lifelong disability, and most of them are not going to have intellectual disability. They may test out at a normal, maybe low normal, but in the normal IQ range, and have a whole host of behavioral, maybe mental health, learning, maybe things like ADHD, so a whole host of other disorders, and the alcohol is just never considered. So it's, the question's not asked. These kids get, told that they have all kinds of issues, but the kind of the core root of the problem of prenatal exposure is never explored. But why is this difficult? Well, it's difficult because people, there's a stigma, and it's thought that so very few people actually have FASD. That's why these newer prevalence studies are so important to us, because when I know at NOFAS, we're a nonprofit charity, and we really struggle. We struggle. It's a miracle we're still alive, because people are not willing to fund FASD prevention. You can't prove that it works. Not that many people have it. Even when we had money to educate, we developed the first medical school curriculum in 1990. And we had money through the Kennedy Foundation, and I called every single university with medical and allied health programs. And, boy, it was like pulling teeth. They're like, no, we don't really want to add that, and we already have too much to teach our students. And, geez, it affects so little. I mean, it's not the top of our list. So it's really getting the resources and having champions. And I just want to mention one of the champions. The champion on the Hill is Senator Lisa Murkowski. Senator Lisa Murkowski has never missed one of our events. She has championed this cause and introduces numerous resolutions and bills, but her office is always very active in trying to get appropriations to CDC and NIH to continue prevention efforts and certainly research. And, your late Senator Ted Stevens, he appropriated some of the first funds for FASD. You guys had the first state office on FASD and were the first state to enact a statute to allow judges to consider FASD as a mitigating factor. If we could have a handful of those champions like that in every state, or even one, boy, it would be a different world. And that's our issue, is that nobody's interested in this, people aren't paying attention, and you got to kind of knock them over the head to try to get them to pay attention. So you can tell I'm a little frustrated.
Here's another aspect that I'm seeing, Thad. I've worked in the prenatal field for years, and one of the things that I see happening is we prenatal providers may have that information. We might have obtained it, but we either are reassuring the woman that it's probably not a problem when we don't really know that, And we may not be documenting that exposure in the prenatal problem risk list in a way that then the pediatric community has access to that, i.e. mm-hmm. where that information is being transferred in the newborn nursery, like right. we do right. any other kind of medical risk right. factor for the newborns. So I think there's some system issues that we could be working on here. And as Kathy said, I think Alaska's the lead in many things related to FASD, and we're hoping to do some more work related to that.
One of the let me real quickly. I have failed once again. It's my usual modus operandi. I get so caught up, I don't let people know how to get a hold of us. We are in the last 7 or 8 minutes, but our local number is 550-8433, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. If someone's listening, would like to try to get a quick question in. I think the comment that was put down is a question before the program that I wanted to consider is that a lot of women, say, hey, I'm not pregnant. I'm not trying to become pregnant. Why do I have to worry about fetal alcohol syndrome or its effects is a good one, particularly if it's true that a lot of young women are involved in having children with fetal alcohol effects. So how would you answer that question?
One of the things that we're seeing is the unintended pregnancy rates really haven't shifted much since I became a midwife in 1982, and that's roughly half of women getting pregnant. Yet the patterns of drinking have shifted. So we have more women now drinking in maybe perhaps an episodic way, where they may be having 4 or 5 or 6 drinks on a Friday, Saturday night, and not realizing that for a woman, that really is defined as a binge. So if that's your 4 or more drinks for a woman's considered a binge, she doesn't have to be knocked down, blackout drunk. So if that's your pattern of using alcohol and you have an alcohol and you have a birth control, oops, or you aren't using effective contraception and become pregnant, you may have an unintended mm-hmm. alcohol-exposed, pregnancy. And then what happens is a lot of women immediately stop. They really do recognize alcohol may not be something they want to be using in pregnancy, with the exception of women who have an addiction and can't stop. But the exposure was at a level where that may still have caused a problem. And I think that by reassuring women that that's okay, we aren't doing them a service. So I really think we have to look at creative and different ways to really grapple with this mm-hmm. unintended pregnancy and recognizing pregnancy earlier. The work done with the pregnancy test in the bathroom, in the bars, mm-hmm. bathroom work a couple years ago here, I think they really came to the conclusion. They had a good sample size, and they were in 4 or 5 communities in a couple bars in each community. They really, I think, one of their takeaways was, we need to get pregnancy testing access to make that easier so women can use it more liberally and be paying attention to that and really recognize what's happening earlier and perhaps do pregnancy testing prior to drinking.
But it's also true, you guys tell me if I'm not right, that the central nervous system is rapidly developing very quickly before women know they're pregnant. And I think it's also true that probably is the most important time for almost all neurotoxins
yes.
to have its effect.
Yes.
So it gets down to either make sure you're not pregnant or don't drink. Are there other answers?
So one of the things I've been seeing for years is women really don't understand their bodies, many women that I've seen. And understanding whether you're in the pre-ovulatory part of your cycle versus the you've ovulated and now you could potentially be pregnant that last half of your cycle, perhaps timing your drinking for the front end of your cycle when you're not likely to have gotten pregnant mm-hmm. could be one strategy for women if we're trying mm-hmm. to tell them what to do instead
right.
of what not to do.
Right.
That's a really, really good point. And I think, another piece to this is that years after the fact, I have women call me confidentially and will confess that they drank before they knew they were pregnant, and now their child is having some issues. Sometimes maybe it is related to that drinking, but sometimes it may not be related at all. And it makes me so sad that we are not arming women with information about their bodies and how their bodies work. And this whole very, very sensitive time, as you pointed out, that of any toxin exposure in that early part of pregnancy. Because what happens is they call and they believe that it's something that they've done and have terrible remorse. So we, you know, we want to alleviate, you know, that from happening to any woman or man, for that matter. I mean, I have fathers call. You know, they're just full of guilt and remorse and worried about, you know, an exposure. And I think the more we can educate women, and women are smart. We just need to do a better job of teaching women about their bodies.
And I think we need to start. I think we need to start at an earlier age. I think, you know, adolescents are hungry for information about their bodies, and we could be giving it to them. And I agree with you. It needs to be both boys and girls who understand this, because he may be the one influencing her to drink. So if he understands this, in a better way, then that may play a role as well. One other comment I want to make sure we get in before the end of the show is there was a very interesting study done. Kathy, I'm sure you saw this as well, out of the University of California, Riverside, about 3 weeks ago. And the researcher was looking at the multi-generational impact of alcohol exposure. And this was a mouse model study where they exposed the first generation pregnant mice to the alcohol and looked at the impact in the offspring. And it was the typical learning and memory and anxiety and some other behaviors in the animals. Then they looked at the next two generations, so the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of that maternal mouse, you know, that they had exposed. They saw the same reduced growth pattern and the same level of neurotoxic impact in those next two generations who had not been exposed to the alcohol. So another message I think we need to be getting out there is that alcohol in pregnancy may be having a multi-generational impact, even if the next two generations aren't drinking.
That is, you know, almost hard for people to believe. We've talked about it before. It's the epigenetic effects. And so environmental exposures, those to stress and to toxins, can have multi-generational effects. It very almost certainly seems to be the case. Yeah. Thanks to Marilyn Pierce-Bolger, Kathleen Tavnerick-Mitchell for joining us today. It's been a very fast and rapid hour. I hope everybody enjoyed it as much as I did. If you want to continue this discussion on fetal alcohol exposure and its prevention, join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at www.alaskapublic.org, where you can also find the archives and listen to this program or refer someone to it if you would like them to listen. Next week, Line 1 is going to return, and our guest is going to be the president of Physicians for a National Health Program, so why not join us and learn more? August 28th at 2 p.m., repeating that same evening at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1, Alaska Public Media. My thanks to Dave Waldron, who worked very hard to get us all on the air appropriately, since I forgot a phone number. Also, I want to thank Eric Bork, who is our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.